From the Atlantic to the Pacific, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from the canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Vance Pollock, in the captain's seat for Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange. Giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest, we have assembled the finest team of reporters and most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here. This hour, adopting ghosts. Is it something that can be done intentionally, or do some people just pick up strays on their travels? I'm lucky to be in the studio with a regular guest, we should say co-hostess, Shelley Wright, who knows a little bit about what I'm getting at, I believe. And we can tell you from personal experience that Asheville has some familiar spirits.
Yes.
It was, goodness, going on 5, 6, 7 years ago. All these things sort of blur together when I think about like the Charleston trip. That was so much fun. Me and you and Forrest riding down to Charleston and getting to hang out with Mark Jones and Rebel and of course Joshua.
Oh yeah.
And that sort of stuff. The years, man, they're just flying by. But some years ago, we were in a building owned by the late Stuart Coleman on Marjorie Street. Now, Marjorie Street is that little alley that runs below the city building between that city parking lot there and down to Valley Street. And there are just a couple parking meters along that lot, and it comes up to Spruce Street, and which then runs along in front of Pax Tavern. That building along Marjorie Street is the last remaining building from a county complex or complex of county related offices that were on that block from the late 1800s up until about 1928 or so, when the new city county complex and plaza was built, and a lot of those older buildings were torn down. I believe the old jail was torn down shortly after World War II. I'm told that the iron framework and everything inside of it was gutted. The radiators and everything were gutted for the war effort during World War II, so that after the war they realized that it was not structurally sound anymore because they had stripped all the metal out of it. And so the old jail building that faced Marjorie Street coming up from Eagle Street there, gone. Parking lots. They tore down, not in this case paradise, and in this case what some people would call hell, and paved over it. But the old jail complex and county complex. This building was once a three-story building, and the upper floors were the Ag Department, Agricultural Extension offices. And there were people from Raleigh representing local farmers and government loans and USDA and things like that on the upper floors. Sometime around 1920 or so, they removed the upper floors of that building and just left the stone. You know, it's got the stone rock exterior. And Stuart gave us entree to that building. As a matter of fact, we set up the original version of Joshua P. Warren's Mystery Museum in that space. It's now in the basement of the Masonic Temple, and that's where the Haunted Asheville tours meet. You're going to want to check out hauntedasheville.com and go on one of those tours if you haven't. And if you have, you're going to want to go on them again, because at the end of the tour, you'll get to see the renovated and revamped basement space.
Have you seen it?
Oh, yes. It's
I've
so
seen it
good.
Too. Oh, it's fabulous.
Josh and Lauren and others spent so much time on that while they were here. greatly improved and condensed, and it's so amazing. Full of wonders.
It has its own private entrance.
Yes, a back alley entrance.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Back alley and down the stairs. Yeah. Oh, creaky steps. And Lauren says that she has seen shadowy forms move.
And she said she got touched.
Oh, my goodness. Uh-huh. Wow. So, the Asheville Mystery Museum, Joshua P. Warren's Mystery Museum. I moderate the Facebook page for that. And it's not always very active, but from time to time there, I'll add a link or throw out some points of local interest. It's not all local stuff. There are items from Transylvania, of course, Puerto Rico, around the world. Art Bell's Alien is there. That alone is worth the price of admission. So take a Haunted Asheville tour. And be sure to visit the new and improved Asheville Mystery Museum in the basement of the Masonic Temple. But when it was on Marjorie Street behind Pax Tavern, one day one of the docents' cat, a friend of ours, was in the building alone. I believe it was a Sunday afternoon. And in the back part of the building, we had a room set up as a theater, seating for about 12, 15 people. And on a loop, Josh was running clips of Conquest of Canaan, which is a film shot in Asheville in 1921. That's pretty cool to have motion pictures from your hometown from 1921.
Definitely.
And so we had those on a loop, and it was very atmospheric. I just loved to sit back in that room and watch clips of that when I was waiting for visitors. And it was like a little time machine, you know. Anyway, Kat was back in there getting ready to close up, turning off the video projector, and turns around and bumps into someone, and then looks to excuse herself. Oh, pardon me. And there's nothing but a black form disappearing as she turns her view, and that's legit. And Kat was terrified.
She was. She called me as soon as it happened. She was freaked out, and that was just the beginning.
Yes, because at the same time, I'm at home researching, rather at random, local law enforcement. I find that a lot of people from the first few decades of the 1900s had a career that was very very much centered around that block. So I'm digging for nuggets regarding our space at the time, and I uncover an article about then Sheriff John Lyerly and the fact that he had shot himself and then died overnight. But it says that he shot himself in the back room of the county garage on Marjorie Street. And I said, hold on a second. So in the course of the next hour or two, I'm comparing records and verifying my hunch that the sheriff did shoot himself in the building that we occupied at that time. And I emailed the article to Josh and presented this information to him, and he said, but did you notice the date? It was that exact date, January 24th, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Some 78 years. Wow. Gosh. Or 88 years, something like that. My chronology is wrong, but I know that the date had not even occurred to me when I sent the article. So we have Kat independently bumping into a shadowy figure and me discovering that he had shot himself in that building. So we began to reach out.
That was the same day?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, the anniversary of his suicide.
The anniversary of his suicide. They both find out about the existence of him.
And we knew nothing about this. Exactly. We knew nothing about this fellow before. And so, John Lyerly, we begin to reach out to him, and we discover that he is an angry spirit that he was a violent man. Well, in law enforcement in those days, you had to be rough and tumble, but he had bludgeoned men to death. He was probably a little sadistic.
Probably. probably.
In his approach. He rather enjoyed it, it seemed. Thomas Wolfe wrote about John Lyerly, or used Sheriff John Lyerly as the inspiration for characters in several of his stories.
So what year would it have been that he was in office?
He was first police chief in 1898. He was sheriff 1920 to 1924. He was sheriff at the time of his suicide. So, and in between, he served in local law enforcement as a captain or chief and at various times. And his brother, Kelly, was also a police chief at one time. So the Lyerlys were well established in local law enforcement. But John Lyerly obviously was sticking around. We found out that the reason he probably had killed himself was because he was mourning the loss of his wife. She had passed away a few years, or just a few months before he killed himself.
Yeah, just a few months. He was devastated.
Soon after, we brought some people in to investigate, and they captured an EVP of a man's voice saying, "Miss her."
Yeah, I'm going to miss her. I think that was, yeah.
So John Lyerly was communicating with us, and plans were on to do a full-scale investigation. And by the time the next anniversary of his death rolled around, we were moving out of that building. So this our period there roughly encompassed 1 year. And John and you got personal toward the end there.
I actually heard him say my name. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. When we were moving into the museum, we had a lot to do. The building was falling apart. We had hung some curtains or something. I'm trying to steam the curtains, get all the wrinkles out, by myself. And I heard my name plainly called from way in the back of the building where everybody says was super haunted. I mean, you could say, "Hey, where do you feel things?" And everybody pointed to the same place. So yeah, I heard him. Plain as day. And I knew I was the only one in the building. So I texted Joshua, and he and Lauren showed up about 10 minutes later.
Let's catch up with Sheriff John after this break. You are listening about how to make friends with ghosts here on Speaking of Strange. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. Are ghosts just lonely? Sometimes I believe that. And the case story of some of our investigations under the auspices of Joshua P. Warren would seem to bear that out. Shelley Wright was talking about becoming familiar with John Lyerly, who was initially quite a cantankerous old cuss, even in death.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was.
Well, you heard him speak your name.
Yeah, I did.
In the farthest back corner, and let me tell you, people, there is no entrance. There is one entrance on the western side of that building, and there is nothing else except for the barred windows facing Marjorie Street, and that back corner actually is built into a bank. Mm-hmm. You may know that those stairs come down from City County Plaza to Marjorie Street to that parking lot across the street. There's a pedestrian crossing, and that little stone building is actually built back into a dirt bank.
Oh, yeah.
At the halfway point of those stairs. So if you're in the back corner of that building, you are basically underground. There's no way anybody can sneak in there. The best ventriloquist in the world couldn't pitch his voice back there in the corner. It's the acoustics wouldn't allow for it, I think. So when you hear your name spoken in the dark back there, it's pretty genuine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was. I had no doubt. I had no doubt I'd heard Sheriff Lyerly.
And then, I mean, what kind of feelings or communication did you try to make with John? Because eventually he wasn't Sheriff Lyerly anymore. You got to know each other on a first-name basis when he called you Shelley. Well, soon after that, he was John, right?
He was. He was. And we all called him John. We all made him human again. We would greet him when we came in. We would say goodbye when we left. If he started making somebody feel uncomfortable and sick, sometimes that happens, I would say, hey, you wait right here. And I'd go back to the back and say, John, you stop it. These are our friends. Stop that. And you know, I mean, yes, I'm taking a chief to task, but it worked. And I think we endeared ourselves to him. I really do. Now, Joshua had a time. He got snowed in there. And remember, he was sleeping in that back room and had his coat pulled off of him. Middle of the night.
Josh has this gray wool trench coat. If anyone's ever seen Josh out about town,
it's like Silent
in cold
Bob.
Weather, he's wearing this gray trench coat. And he got snowed in to that stone building and covered up in the back and just pulled his trench coat up over him and had it snatched off in the middle of the night. How does that happen? In the room where the psychomantium was set up. That's another story.
Yeah.
But we were asking for it, so to speak. And when I was in there, I had a very open mind toward communicating with John, and I continued to do what I do, the history, the research, and uncover more newspaper articles and tales about him. Acquired some of Thomas Wolfe's more rare short stories, who have characters allegedly inspired by John Lyerly, and the parallels to some actual news items that I found unmistakable. That Thomas Wolfe, the Thomas Wolfe, had borrowed this man's life to illustrate some of his stories. So that's pretty impressive when you lead a life that is so large that it's literary, you know, that people use your life as a literary device. And it was happening again and again in the writing of Thomas Wolfe. Wow. Interesting character, this John Lyerly. He was a manhunter. He was quite good with the bloodhounds.
Yeah.
Local saying had it, John Lyerly always gets his man. And one of his bloodhounds, Old Joe, had a good nose. You know, he was called into surrounding counties. Old Joe had a good nose. He was John was called into surrounding counties to hunt for missing persons and fugitives. And there's a story of him going to Polk County to hunt for a missing woman, and he finds her high atop of a mountain where she had gone to sulk because she was basically...
Because that's all you had to do back then.
Yeah, if you get mad at your husband, you stomp off up the mountain and sulk. So that's all she was. She was up there sulking. And John and old Joe found her and said, come on home. And with the help of a rolling pin, I think she probably straightened things out and back to wedded bliss. But that's John Lyerly. I mean, not just in Asheville, but surrounding counties, like I say. There are reports from Morganton, reports from Silva, Waynesville. John Lyerly and his hounds, call them. They'll get them. And it was true. He was a manhunter. And he was on the trail of Will Harris after those notorious shootings in November of 1906.
Yes.
And we know how that ended up with Will Harris practically lynched. I mean, shot, riddled with bullets and put on display in a shop window. And well, maybe then, some souvenirs taken of some of his digits. And, yeah, very gruesome
people
stuff.
People kept shooting his body. It was out on display, and people just walked by, and they'd shoot his body.
Right. Wow. Rough days, yeah, the wild and woolly days of Asheville. It sounds like the Old West. But before we left the building, you did go in with a message for John.
Well, here's the thing. We had moved the day before, and I had an appointment, and I came back, and the rest of the moving had already finished up. So I went back the next day for this stupid little TV stand. It wasn't worth anything. For some reason, I went back. We used it as a table. Remember?
Right.
And so I was just going to go pick it up. And I walk in, and immediately, he's right there. I didn't have to call him to me. He is right there, and he is angry. I mean, he is so angry. You know how floodwaters, they swirl and they rise, and that was his anger. It was swirling and it was rising, and I just started talking to him, and he's still getting madder and madder at me. And then he starts circling me, and I keep trying to talk to him and calm him down, and he was really angry because he felt like we had left him. Nobody, I don't think, had actually said, hey, by the way, John, we're moving. We just moved. We didn't say anything. We left him. And he was really, really upset. So I knew that he had been there to protect the building. He's a lawman. He's trying to keep peace. And he did that for all those years. He stayed behind and lost his wife. And I just talked to him about, you know, I think maybe it's time, you know, you've done your time. Why don't you just go be with your wife? I know how much you loved her. Well, when I started talking about his wife, that made him even madder. So I'm trying to calm him down again. The floodwaters of anger just keep rising. I mean, like, to my waist at this point. And he's still circling me. And he's so mad. And so I didn't tell him that he had to leave. I gave him the option. It occurred to me that maybe he felt like he needed to be there. I mean, you know, in that era, when you commit suicide, you feel tainted. You know, it's taboo.
There is a stigma.
There was a stigma, and maybe and he was a you know, God fearing man. So I figured maybe he doesn't feel like he's, you know, he can go on. Maybe he didn't feel like he would be welcomed in. So I just talked to him for a while and said, look, I know how much you loved your wife. I think that you need to be with her. And I told him to look around. I said, I know that there is a light for you, but I think you need to forgive yourself before you can see that light. It just occurred to me while I was talking to him that maybe that was the case, that maybe part of it is that you have to forgive yourself. You have to feel like you are worthy of it before you can see it. And he calmed down, but I said, look, you don't have to do this. You can stay if you want to, but I think this would be good for you. I think you need to go. and told him that we all loved him, and I think I wished him well, and I took my little crappy TV cart and walked out to the car, and I sit in the car, and tears start coming down my face, and so I thought, oh, he's already gone.
Oh, let's check in with John for the last time when we come back from these messages. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.
Beacons forged from the fire. Or maybe a tree. Gonna lay with the ghost by my side. Let the birds take to the sky. Gonna try.
Moving right along in hour two of Speaking of Strange here on WWNC. Joshua P. Warren, Speaking of Strange. I'm Vance Pollock in the pilot seat for this episode. And we're talking about adopting a ghost, making friends with the ghosts. Do ghosts just need some attention? And I think they do.
Ghosts are people too.
Ghosts are people too. Bumper sticker, Sam. You're right. You're keeping track of all these T-shirts and bumper stickers. Ghosts are people too.
I used to have a book, and I would write down things. And I found it when I was moving, and it had some funny potential bumper sticker ideas on it. But
you ask the spirit of Sheriff John Lyerly to look around for the light. Maybe you want to consider going to be with your wife. You love her. What's here for you?
Yeah.
And you went out to your car and broke down. It was very emotional for
it
you.
Was.
It was a very real.
It was. And by the time I left there and drove down the street, seems like I had to pull into a shopping center because I was crying so hard at that point. And you know me, I'm not a crier. I was just so emotional. I was all choked up. I couldn't do anything but just cry.
So the anniversary of John Lyerly's suicide and death, late January, couple years later, late January, I get an email from investigator Shelley Wright saying, Vance, you know, the anniversary of John's death is coming up. And I think I'd like to drop by his grave out there at Beaver Dam and put some flowers out. I said, you know, I've been thinking about John a lot lately. And it's funny, you should contact me first because I've got a little something I'd like to tell you, even show you, pertaining to our friend John Lyerly. You see, I had continued to research the man, just whenever he would cross my mind, keep him in my thoughts back there, and every now and then he would pop his head out and say hello. It seemed like,
yeah.
And I'd be like, well, John, let's see if you're communicating out there in cyberspace. I tried to track down descendants and relatives. He had one daughter, Lillian, who married and had two sons. They had, one of the sons died with no children. One of the sons had a couple of children. I was in touch with what would now be John's great-grandchildren. They didn't know so much about their grandfather. No photographs. They knew he had been a sheriff or a police chief here in Asheville. They'd heard that much, but really didn't know a whole lot about him. They were somewhat estranged from their father. But the grandson, who never had any children, late in life, he married an Asheville woman and died a short time later. They had dated for years, but they were only married for a very short time before he passed away. And by that time, she was gone as well. But I found an obituary for her that listed some children and grandchildren. And how many degrees of separation is this? I email the granddaughter of the woman that John Lyerly's grandson was married to when he was an old guy, just before he died. And I mentioned Lyerly to her, and she said, or Taft, the grandson's name was Taft. I mentioned Mr. Taft, who was married to her grandmother, and she said, oh, yeah, I knew him. He was a nice guy, and I have some of his things. So when I go to meet Shelley at John Lyerly's grave, I have a package that's been mailed to me from this granddaughter of the woman who was married to the grandson of John Lyerly. Can you keep that straight even?
Yeah.
And I have this package from California, a long package. And I get a walking stick out, and we head over to the grave. And one other point, it was about 12 degrees. It was a hard cold
there
that morning.
There was a frostbite warning. They were saying, do not get out, because
the ground was frozen as a rock.
It was miserable.
And that grass in the cemetery crunching under your feet. But I step out to the graveside, and I've got this walking stick, and I hold the head of this cane to you, and it's a metal or gold trim on the head of this cane with an inscription. I said, can you read that? And it's an inscription to Chief John A. Lyerly from the Asheville Police Department, 1898.
I have pictures. Did you know that? I took pictures.
I'll share them. It was a great thing.
It was an unopened package from 1898?
It was an unopened package the day before when I got it in the mail. Oh. But she had told me about it and mailed it to me the week before Shelley sent me this email and said, we need to go out to John Lyerly's grave. So the day before we're going out to his graveside, I get this cane in the mail, this walking stick, and show up there and hand it to Shelley and say, I think you might want to take a look
at
this.
And that's at the graveyard, like in the sharp curve.
In Beaver Dam, yeah. The one next to the church.
Yeah.
There's the Lewis Memorial Park up with the flat stones, but then there's the standing stones next to the Beaver Dam Baptist Church there. So the church cemetery is the section where Lyerly is buried.
Like where Kimberly comes out at?
Yeah.
And did you notice when we were standing there at the, right there in front of the grave, it was warm the entire time we stood there and we visited John and his wife. It was warm. We were comfortable.
Yes, the sun was shining there. So it was toasty. It was 12 degrees, but right there at that plot, at John's grave plot, it was warm.
And it shouldn't have been. Now, when we moved, out a little ways and we went walking around
it
was miserably cold. Again, we went back.
It was so peaceful. And like you said during the break, you think that all of this played out just the way it should have.
I think so.
I still get signs from John. I'll still run across little newspaper articles and things like that. Mm-hmm. Like I say, one of the last ones I found was an advertisement for when he was running for sheriff that said, remember, vote for your friend John Lyerly, sheriff.
Wow.
And just to read the language of that note, your friend John Lyerly was like a message from him. And it is kind of emotional to think that you've made friends with a ghost.
Exactly.
Is it like paranormal Pokemon Go? You go out and you meet people, instead of going to the bars and mixing with singles, you go to the cemetery and pick
with
up
dead
ghosts?
People? Well, I do not think that when people go on, I don't think it's a one-way door. I think they can come back. They can check in on you. Mm-hmm. They can see what's going on.
Even if you had no connection to them in life, you can get through or
mm-hmm.
become acquainted with them.
And these connections will come to you. You don't necessarily have to go looking for them.
I don't know that we have time to tell it in all its detail, but O.C. Hamilton is a friend of ours now. And I told Josh, I don't believe I told you, we found out that O.C. Hamilton, who built the Sky Club up on Bowcatcher Mountain, was actually a Roman Catholic priest from Chicago who had got a woman pregnant and brought her to Asheville under an assumed name and set her up so she could raise their daughter here. Oh, the scandal.
Yes.
But it was a story of love. I think when we found out who O.C. Hamilton really was, the Reverend John J. Carroll, that he was relieved to get that off his chest. We have a friend, a lady friend, a blonde barmaid there. If that's not too dismissive, she's so much more than that. She's a manager there. She's a friend. And I put the call out to some people saying, in 2017, I'm going to do some hobby genealogy. Anybody want me to look into their family history for them? And she was one of the few people that contacted me and said, I know very little about my grandfather's family other than his parents were supposedly from Palermo, Sicily, New York City, and they, you know, lived in New York City where he grew up and lived most of his life in Brooklyn. I said, wow, New York City Italians, that's pretty vague.
Right.
But I soon got a line on them, and I found a family of this name, which was not a very common name, Bonino, and the spelling got absolutely slaughtered in the early American records when they were recently off the boat. But I found a census record in New York City from 1930, and at the very top of the page was the Bonino family, this friend's grandparents,
right.
Great-grandparents. And the entry, the very first entry on the top of that census page was John J. Carroll, not the Reverend Father John J. Carroll, but the name John J. Carroll, just pretty as you please, wow. Right up top there, like, she works in the place where we met O.C. Hamilton, a.k.a. John J. Carroll. And when I go looking for her ancestors, John J. Carroll is looking over them. He's watching over them. I took a clip of this and sent to Josh, and he said, wow, this gives me chills.
Chills, yeah.
So there we go. We've got a new friend, John Carroll. Welcome to the fold, John Lyerly, John Carroll. I might mention A.J. Wills, who was a prominent architect in Asheville around the turn of the century. I feel like I know him through similar research. So can you make friends with ghosts? Should you make friends with ghosts?
Yeah, yes. I think so.
That's a good point to take a break on. Let that ruminate, if you will. It's what we do here on Speaking of Strange. Could Asheville be Spook City, USA? It's Beer City in some people's estimate. Why not Spook City, USA? And when we let Danzig present that question, that's appropriate for our good friend, investigator Shelley Wright, who has helped me so much to plead my case this second hour, which is that ghosts appreciate the attention. They appreciate respectful commiseration,
right.
You know? Maybe we could be like ghost psychiatrists.
You never know. I think when you acknowledge it.
We'll ask Josh if ghostpsychiatrist.com is available. He probably owns that one.
He owns everything else.
Joshua P. Warren, of course, is warm and cozy down in Puerto Rico while we're up here freezing in Spook City, USA. But when I think of Shelley Wright, I think of this rock and roll chick that rode down to Charleston with us and brought along the first Danzig album and Joan Jett and the Blackhearts' greatest hits. That was so
fun.
I did bring
that, didn't I?
Yeah,
oh, yeah, you
we
made me leave Eminem at home. But I brought Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. I did bring Danzig, didn't I?
Oh, yeah, you brought that first Danzig, you know, Mother. And I had to play Am I Demon and Possession. There's some dark stuff
evil?
On there. Am I Evil?
Yeah, not Demon. Am I Evil?
No, you're right. Am I Demon for Me to Know? That's a different song,
right?
I liked
Danzig to Lucifuge with Devil's Plaything. That was my jam.
Yeah, he's got some really dark and good stuff out there. Like
After Black Araya or whatever.
Tired of Being Alive. Yeah.
Tired of Being Alive is a good one.
Tired of Being Alive is great.
Blood and Tears, a little ballad.
When Death Had No Name. Ooh, so many good ones. He did some writing for Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison. You
got
to hear that stuff. I'll hip you to that. He did some pretty cool collaborations. Rick Rubin hooked him up.
Huh.
And he wrote some stuff for Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison. Pretty amazing. So, yeah, Glenn Danzig, hats off. You're my brother from another mother.
Roy Orbison singing like Danzig.
Mother, yeah, I would like to hear a Roy Orbison version of Mother. That didn't happen, but a Johnny Cash version of 13. Do you know that off of the American recordings? The first American recordings had 13, Bad Luck Wind Been Blowing At My Back. That's a Danzig tune,
yeah.
Man. And you can, the lyric structure and everything is obviously Danzig
so
once you know that.
At that point, that when Rick Rubin and Johnny Cash hooked up like that, that Johnny Cash's career was... Like, he was basically playing theaters, like small theaters in Branson.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
What?
Yeah, he was definitely on the way out popularity-wise, and he revived that. Man, that's great.
Rick Rubin seems like a guy that would be really cool to hang out with and talk to.
Yeah, oh, man, I would like to pitch some career revival suggestions to Rick Rubin if
very zen,
if the other people.
You know?
I would like him to revive the career of Jerry Lee Lewis. I would like him to revive the career of...
He's so cantankerous.
I mean, know, exactly. You can't work with the guy. They say the same thing about Chuck Berry, but Chuck Berry's supposedly recording a new album. He's, almost 90 years old, and he's working on a new album?
For the last 5-7 years, I've been wanting to go. I think he's doing it now once every 2 months or 3 months, but he was once a month. You know, he was playing at his club in St. Louis, if I'm correct. He has a bar up there, and he would still play, you know, a gig per month. And I was like, I got to go see him before he dies, you know. Like, it was really hard to get tickets for because it doesn't seat very many people.
Well, if we miss him on this side, maybe Shelley can help us make friends with him from beyond the veil. What celebrity ghost would you like to be? Your friend. Which celebrity ghost would you like to adopt?
He sounded like Fred.
I don't know.
Sounded like Mr. Rogers.
He did. I don't know.
Would you like to adopt George Michael?
You don't know. That's a serious question,
I don't know. I would have to think about it. But probably what would happen is, because you know me, I am a ghost magnet, they would just find me.
Joshua P. Warren feels
very close to the spirits of some of our founding fathers. Has he told you some of those stories? Thomas Jefferson, George Washington.
Whoever's on the $20 bill.
Andrew Jackson. No, but Josh can tell some pretty fascinating stories about communication with what we should call illustrious ghosts.
I think if you're going to have a ghost friend from, you know, from Mr. Rogers is probably a good one to have because or Bob Ross. Like,
yeah, oh, man. Those would be great guys to hang out with. Oh, my goodness. That was a fun hour, guys. I hope you, dear listener, have enjoyed it as well. Think about that. Something to keep in mind. And they don't have to be famous ghosts. Just the ghost down the street. Or in the
ghost
haunted
down
house
the
next
street.
Door.
I get ghosts down my street. I've got a cemetery at the top of mine. They're really great tenants. Residents. Very friendly.
Coming up, something I've been dreading for weeks. The dark 30 hour. How am I going to do it? How am I going to handle this?
Ugh. You're a professional. You can do it.
Speaking of strange...